It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a former Dairy Queen about what it means to be Alice in Dairyland.
First, one Wisconsin lawmaker is trying to require food stamp recipients in the state to show photo ID when they use their benefits at the store. He says the measure is necessary to cut down on food stamp fraud and abuse. He's crafted a bill that would require new electronic benefit transfer cards with photo identification to participants in Wisconsin's food share program.
Representative Jesse Kramer, a Republican from Keewaskum, is here to talk about the bill, which is currently being circulated for co-sponsorship. Representative Kramer, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, spell out the basics for us. Why do we need to include a photo component to these benefit cards here in Wisconsin?
Well, this is something that that some other states have looked into in the past years, and even states like New York and Massachusetts have used in the past. Basically, the food share program works, and what used to be called food stamps, now it's food share. The benefits are put on what's called a Quest card, which is a debit card, and that debit card has really cut down on a lot of the fraud over the years since it started to be implemented about a decade ago. Because there's a PIN included on that card, and it's harder for people to traffic these who do want to use them fraudulently. I mean, obviously the people that are in need aren't doing that, but there are people out there taking advantage of the system. And one way we can potentially cut down on some of that fraud, and to go back just a little bit, there's two types of fraud. There's the provider fraud, which would be like, say, a grocery store, or there's recipient fraud, so whoever has a card. So what we'd be doing here is working a little bit on the recipient end. And right now, there's actually the national average is about 1.3% of the benefits that are given out are still being used fraudulently. Now, as I mentioned before, years ago, it used to be more up in the 5-6% range, but that's cut down quite a bit.
So the idea here is the one way that fraud might work is if I had the card, I could, I don't know, sell it or exchange it for something to someone else, and
correct.
I would have to give them the PIN number for them to be able to successfully use it,
correct.
And then the wrong person is receiving that. So do we have a sense of how often that specific kind of fraud that would happen that a photo would prevent?
Well, as I mentioned, we would have no idea. What we do know is... As I mentioned, it's about 1.3% on average in the nation. And when a state like Wisconsin alone is giving out, it's actually up to about $1.1 billion a year now in actual benefits we're giving out, that amounts to about $14 million that's being thrown away. Since Governor Walker took office, we've since begun a program with the Office of the Inspector General. His name is Mr. White, and he works in DHS, Department of Health Services. And he has actually started a program to go after a lot of this recipient fraud without a photo ID on the cards. And a lot of that fraud was occurring on the social media, Facebook, Craigslist, and eBay. And just last year alone, there were 7,300 investigations, and we actually saved, it was 0.6%. Of that $1.1 billion, but it wound up, we saved over $6.5 million just with that alone. So if there's another 0.6% out there that we can maybe stop with a photo ID, I'm willing to look at that. I mean, $6 million is not chump change by any means. And this program is meant for the truly needy, and we want to make sure that the people that need those benefits, that extra $6 million that's out there being used fraudulently, should be used for the people who truly do need it. And we want to make sure that those people are getting the benefits that they deserve.
How much would it cost to implement these photo IDs and to keep them going from year to year?
Yeah, the initial cost we just got from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, which is a nonpartisan agency that works for the legislature. And they went on worst-case scenario. So worst-case scenario being that everyone in the household that's able to use a card would be issued a card with a photo on it. So that worst-case scenario to implement, to start the program, would be about $7 million, a little over $7 million. Now, that's the way the program is administered, it's a 50-50 match. The state covers half the administration. The federal government covers the other half. So it would be about $3.5 million we'd be on the hook in the state. Annually after that, it'd be about $2 million to operate the program. So $1 million on the state and $1 million on the federal government. Obviously, if this program were to work, there'd be a law of diminishing returns. If we wind up recovering, stopping a lot of the peddling of these cards, well, long term, I mean, there might be a reason to stop putting photos on cards when we realize, it's not really paying off anymore to do such a thing. Massachusetts actually had the program for years until Governor Romney stopped it in, he was still governor just before he ran for president. And now Massachusetts is actually going back to putting them on the cards again. So you've obviously got to weigh that cost analysis. Is it worth it or isn't it?
Talking to Assembly Representative Jesse Kramer about his effort to get photo ID on food share cards, what used to be called food stamps, an anti-fraud effort. One concern that's been raised, Representative Kramer, is that the card is given to a household, the head of the household, not an individual. Anyone in the household can use the card, but maybe there's just mom's picture or dad's picture. So if a spouse tries to use it, a kid tries to use it, this may be a hurdle for a legitimate use of a card.
That's correct. And therein lies the problem with the program. The way we have, what this bill does is it actually tells our Department of Health Services to request a waiver from the federal government to allow, say, if someone goes to a grocery store, to allow that grocery store actually to mandate that they look at the photo on the card. Now, obviously, if you've got everyone in the household that has to be able to use that card, there's a problem here because everyone's photo is not going to be on that card. So that is a snag in the program, and thus the reason that we went with the worst-case scenario when we were analyzing the cost. If we were to give one of these out to everyone in the household that's able to use a card, well, that would alleviate some of those problems.
And one of the reasons that you need that waiver is, as I understand it, federal law says you're not supposed to pay special attention to a food share card. You're supposed to treat it like a debit card if you're the, say, clerk at a grocery store. Some people have said this is an extra stigma, an extra step of drawing attention to people receiving food assistance. Is that a worry for you?
Well, and that's the concern of the federal government, yes. And I think, to be honest with you, I think everyone that goes to a grocery store knows if there's someone in line that has one of these cards. It's fairly obvious, unless you're checking out in a lane that doesn't have a cashier. But it's not. I don't know. The majority of us in society that understand that there are needy people that really need these programs, and they're meant to be there for people that have fallen on tough times. So it is not logical citizens of the state of Wisconsin, and I do not feel should be looking at that as a stigma. It shouldn't be meant as a stigma. We all fall on hard times. I've used programs, and I've been in unemployment. I've used programs in the past. I used heating assistance for a year. These are meant for people that are truly in need, and it's not something that we should be stigmatizing, but I'm not saying that people would not. That's how I feel about it.
Now that you're bringing this bill forward, are you seeing support both from your own party and maybe bipartisan support from Democrats?
I haven't yet. I haven't heard anything from the Democrats. I mean, we obviously all, it's not like you see in the media where we all can't stand each other in Madison. We all talk, we're all cordial, we all discuss things among each other, but I haven't seen much from my Democratic colleagues yet that they're interested in this. In other states, it has been a bipartisan. Obviously, you see New York had it. That's a pretty Democratic state. Massachusetts is bringing it back again. So it doesn't fall along party lines. In theory, it should be a bipartisan bill. We'll see what happens going forward.
And what is the next step going forward?
We put it out for circulation. We've got signers on the bill, and then it is up to leadership now in the Assembly to decide if it's going to come out for a committee hearing or not. And that could be as early as this spring or maybe even this fall.
All right, Representative Kramer, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Rob.
That was State Assembly Representative Jesse Kramer. He was with us to talk about his bill that would require those who use food aid to show photo ID when making purchases. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on Friday night, former Olympian and reality TV star Bruce Jenner announced that even though he's biologically a man, he identifies as a woman. We'll talk to an expert about what it means to be transgender.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin's new queen, Allison Dairyland, will soon be crowned. This talk of queens got historian Erica Janik thinking about the long history of women and agriculture.
Some girls dream of being a movie star. Me? I've got a thing for agricultural queens like Alice in Dairyland. Alice is Wisconsin's agricultural royalty. She travels the state during her year-long reign talking up the importance of farming. Alice in Dairyland got her start in 1948 at the Wisconsin Centennial Exposition. Margaret McGuire Blott had the honor of being the first Alice. Her early years were a bit strange. At the state fair, a huge papier-mâché Alice would answer questions from children while the real one sat backstage and threw her voice. But she also got to travel the country. Early Alices logged more than 150,000 miles a year. They went to Hollywood, rode in the Rose Parade, and danced with Lawrence Welk on TV. I met my first Alice at the Wisconsin State Fair, where I got to shake her hand. She also gave me a cow-shaped air freshener. This was only my first encounter with Wisconsin royalty, though. I once took a class with Wisconsin's honey queen. She wore a different honey t-shirt every day. I thought at first she just really liked honey. Wisconsin's royalty isn't just confined to dairy and honey, though. We've also got a cranberry queen, a brown Swiss queen, and a cherry blossom queen, among others. And as lovable and endearing as they may seem, these agricultural queens have an ancient history. For thousands of years, women have been associated with agriculture and the harvest. Women are symbolic of the earth, fertility, and abundance, the very things that people hoped for their crops. The mystery of life, especially birth, was one area where women had deep firsthand knowledge, and fertility goddesses, particularly Mother Earth, found their roots in agriculture. All over the world, from Asia and Africa to Europe and South America, female goddesses represented the fruitful plains as well as the work of tending to them. The Greeks had Demeter, who was said to have invented agriculture and all of the rituals associated with it. The Romans had Ceres, as well as Pomona, to keep an eye on the fruit trees. Hindu goddesses watched over food, the harvest, and nourishment. In North and South America, a corn mother gave life to the continent's staple crop. Corn, along with beans and squash, were known as the Three Sisters because the plants were said to embody female spirits. So Alice in Dairyland and Wisconsin's other queens aren't just some pre-feminist holdover from the 1940s and 1950s. They're the modern incarnation of a tradition that stretches back thousands of years to people and cultures around the world.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
And while you're there, you can check out a lot of recent Wisconsin Life stories. Check out their various their game series. And a lot of other just unique takes on what it's like to live in Wisconsin and Wisconsin culture. By the way, coming up in just a bit, we'll talk to an expert about what it means to be transgender. The issue was put in the spotlight by an interview, Bruce Jenner talking to Diane Sawyer last Friday. And then we'll take a look at fracking later today. Representative Mark Pocan of Wisconsin introducing legislation that would put an end to fracking in state and national parks.
That's right. And right now we'll be talking to a true dairy queen. Joining us now is Debbie Crave, Vice President of Crave Brothers Farmstead Cheese and a former Alice in Dairyland. Debbie, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, you were the 34th Alice in Dairyland. Take us back. What was that experience like for you?
I was selected in Dodge County way back in 1981, and it was a lengthier process, but still similar today with interviews and different appearances and even a parade, several different judges, more finalists. We called them finalists at the time, and the event ended with a coronation ceremony, so there was a bit of hoopla involved, and now it's quite structured as a business interview, but many of those same activities are still there, the interviews and selection process. And certainly it was very exciting and big deal for me, kind of launched my career in agriculture.
Yeah, what kind of responsibilities did you have while you were serving as Alice of Dairyland, or Alice in Dairyland?
Sure. I did a lot of what was called Wisconsin Cheese Festivals around the country, working with the American Dairy Association of Wisconsin. We didn't have
And I'm afraid we just lost our guest. We'll work on getting her back. And what about you? Do you have any experience with one of these sorts of agricultural things? Let's see if we've got Debbie Crave back with us now. Debbie, are you there?
I'm sorry. Yes, I'm back. We didn't have a Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board at the time, so but we had an American Dairy Association. So I was able to go to Los Angeles and be on Romper Room, which I thought was a big deal, Buffalo, New York, New Orleans, Connecticut. And we did radio and TV interviews about Wisconsin cheese, had a 100-foot cheese festival, and really did a lot of promotion.
A 100-foot cheese festival, what's that?
Well, it was a concentrated effort over the course of a couple of weeks to promote Wisconsin cheese in a region where cheese was already sold and people could buy it and learn about it. And I think there's similar efforts today, but certainly called other things. And I was lucky to kind of be a part of that event for a few days, fly in, do some media, some personal appearances. When I say do media, I mean radio and TV interviews. And a lot of other things that I did, though, were school visits, a lot of education of youth, and that's something that is maintained today. I know Alice meets with a lot of fourth graders because they study agriculture, and so they want to always, you know, emphasize that importance of Wisconsin agriculture and dairying to youth, because we have a great tradition in our state of producing high-quality food, dairy products, fruits and vegetables, as Erica mentioned in her story about agricultural queens. So,
talking to Debbie Crave, former Alice in Dairyland, now Vice President of Crave Brothers Farmstead Cheese. And Alice, did your Alice in Dairyland experience help prepare you for a professional career in the agriculture field?
Yes. Great question. I was a forestry horticulture major in college, and I was all set to work for the Forest Service out west. Now, I did marry a dairy farmer, so that kept me in Wisconsin. But through the marketing activities of Alice in Dairyland, it really launched my career in marketing. And for right after I was finished with Alice in 1983, I worked at the Department of Ag for 15 years in marketing and promoting Wisconsin ag products, and even with the Alice in Dairyland program. And then I went on to work for the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board, and now our own family business. We have a dairy farm and a cheese factory, and we're proud to be a part of the state's great dairy tradition. So, yes, it was integral, and you would find that with many of the Alices over the years, that the position of Alice in Dairyland really helped them get started in a great career.
And, Debbie, we read that one of the things you had to do was to go head-to-head against a New Orleans Saints football player in a crawfish-eating contest. What was that about?
Oh, and I wish I had a picture of that. A big guy, and yes, a plate piled high with crawfish. And to me, they were just crayfish, something that you would see under the pier up north when we would go on vacation in Hayward. So here I am faced with this pile of crawfish with the heads on. I learned you're supposed to break it in half, suck on the head, and then, eat the rest. It was a promotional event to attract attention to, the Cheese Festival, Wisconsin, and just some of those kinds of gimmick things are part of what you do to promote and have fun, in the job. And it was great. I'm sure I didn't really win, but we made a good time of it.
Debbie, you've been Alice in Dairyland. You work in an agricultural industry now. We hear often about a growing role of women in agriculture and, of course, a long historical role there, too. What would you say to younger women looking at a career in some kind of agricultural field?
I have one of those. I have a 17-year-old daughter, and I've been talking to her a lot about even a biology education major and what she could do even with that degree in agriculture, because there's a lot of great jobs out there, from science and education to working on farms and in food production facilities. And I'm happy to see that Alice in Dairyland's in its, I think, 68th year. I found that incredible. I don't feel that old. So, that's a great job too, because it's a good launching point for a lot of different positions, even in ag, from marketing and food production to running your own business. One of the Alices is a great PR firm in the city here. So Can't say enough about it. I'm happy to be a part of the tradition, and it is that. It's a wonderful tradition.
And what does it mean to you, looking back now, to have been a part of that Alice in Dairyland legacy?
Oh, I'm quite proud. Sometimes I'm amazed that I managed. Many of us former Alices will say that, wow, aren't you glad you applied when you did, because it's so difficult now. And we all say that to each other. We have a nice sisterhood. We keep in touch, many of us. And I'm working on some oral histories even for the program with some other people, just to not lose those stories and experiences, because there's some fascinating ones. And you mentioned some earlier, the Alices that might have been in the Rose Bowl or traveling all over, but I think every Alice has some sort of unique experience. And we all usually picked a different sort of theme and focus in my era of Alice to talk about throughout the year, so that led to many interesting stories and kind of the making a difference in people's lives. When you hear little children or people that are now adults say, oh, I remember meeting Alice and this is what I did because of it, really makes it all worthwhile.
Well, Debbie,
you know,
thanks
you
so
can
much.
Make an impact. And I think agriculture needs that, and women need that.
Well, Debbie, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about it today.
You're welcome. Happy to be a part of your show, and sorry for the confusion.
Oh, no problem. That was Debbie Cray, Vice President of Cray Brothers Farmstead Cheese and former Alice in Dairyland.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a new study suggests local roads in Wisconsin aren't getting the money and attention they need and are dramatically declining in quality.
First, on Friday night, former Olympic athlete and reality TV star Bruce Jenner put a spotlight on a national conversation about gender. In an exclusive interview with ABC's Diane Sawyer, Sawyer asked him if he's a woman.
Yes, for all intents and purposes, I am a woman. People look at me differently. They see you as this macho male, but my heart and my soul and everything that I do in life, it is part of me. That female side is part of me. That's who I am.
The interview has sparked a lot of discussion and questions about transgender people. Laurie Cook-Daniels joins us now. She's the Policy and Program Director for FORGE, a national organization for transgender people and their significant others, friends and family members, headquartered in Milwaukee. Laurie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So even after Bruce Jenner's interview, a lot of people are still a bit confused about what exactly it means to be transgender. So let's start there. What does it mean to be transgender?
What it means to be transgender is that who you know yourself to be is not what people expect, or what you, and it may not be what you look like. So, for instance, my father wanted me to be a lawyer, and I looked and looked and looked, and there was no lawyer inside me. So we all have expectations of what someone should be, but sometimes that expectation is not what they feel is the truth.
So in this case, Bruce Jenner may present to the world like a man, have the biology of a man, but he identifies as a woman. Is that right?
That's correct.
And the issue of pronouns is something that comes up in this interview. Bruce Jenner said people should use the pronouns he and him. Is that typical of someone who's transgender?
That is the part of Bruce's story that is fairly unusual. Most of the time when a person has been assigned a male at birth like Bruce and decides that they really are a woman, most of the time they use the pronoun she and use a feminine name. And I expect that Bruce will probably do that further on. What makes him a little unusual is that he's continuing to use Bruce and he. But since what we all want is to be respected for who we are, the respectful thing at this point is to continue to call him Bruce and he, just like he asked.
Well, this interview with Diane Sawyer, it seemed as though it had the potential to be a big moment for transgender people in American culture. What did you think of that interview?
Well, I thought it was a great interview. It is extremely unusual. I don't know that there's any precedent for giving a trans person 2 hours to talk about their identity and their history. And so that was unprecedented and really, really quite wonderful.
And what do you think the public transitioning of someone like Bruce Jenner, so very much in the public eye thanks to his association with the Kardashian family, what does this have the potential to do for the transgender community?
Well, I know what it has done already. which is that we have collected reports from across the country of trans people getting calls and letters and emails from family members and friends who had written them off when they first came out, saying, now that I've seen Bruce, I understand better. I'd like to talk to you again. So Bruce's interview is mending a lot of broken relationships, and I can't think of anything better than that.
You use the term coming out, which is a term that I've heard before for when people come out as gay or lesbian. So I guess it's also appropriate in this case.
It is appropriate because when you come out as gay or lesbian, you're saying to people, this is who I am. And that is exactly what Bruce is saying. Bruce is saying, I am internally a woman.
Now, some media outlets like Time Magazine, for instance, have suggested that we might be at a transgender turning point. Allure Magazine featured a transgender actress. Vogue profiled its first ever transgender model recently. How significant is just the sheer visibility factor right now for the transgender community in raising awareness and maybe changing things?
Well, I have been doing lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender advocacy for 40 years now. And the amount of change and public visibility and policy changes that are happening around transgender people at this point in time, I think is unprecedented. I don't think we've ever had a stigmatized minority in U.S. history that has moved so far so fast. It's extremely exciting.
We're talking to Laree Cook Daniels right now about transgender people. This all tied to Bruce Jenner's interview last Friday night with Diane Sawyer about being transgender. And let's talk a little bit about this process of transitioning, which I gather is what Bruce Jenner is going through. What happens when someone transitions?
Well, not every transgender person does transition, so we should explain that first. Sometimes people are happy just saying, you know, this is who I am inside, and I don't need to make any changes in who you see out in the world. Most often, though, people do make some physical changes, which could be as simple as changing their clothes or changing their hairstyles. Other times, people do much more in terms of changing how they look, including, for instance, using hormones and or having surgery.
So is this the right word for what's happening in this case with Bruce Jenner?
Well, Bruce was a little discreet about exactly his process, his physical process, but it does sound like he's using hormones. It does sound like he's had a couple surgeries, probably facial surgeries, and is contemplating genital surgery. So in that sense, it is fairly consistent with what a lot of people do.
So it sounds as though there are some typical things that happen, but that every transition unfolds differently according to that person.
Absolutely. That is true of everything, that we may go through similar patterns, but we're all going to be unique and we're all going to do it our own way.
Does age play much of a factor in this?
I founded the Transgender Aging Network in 1998, so I've done almost 20 years of working with transgender people who transition in mid or late life. And what I heard from Bruce's story was very common to me, which was that he did start trying to transition or to live as a woman earlier in adulthood and gave it up in order to protect his family from what he felt might be very difficult. And then later on decided, no, I can't do this anymore. I need to be who I am. I only have a certain amount of time left. And that is a common story for transgender people who do wait until mid or later life.
Now, one thing that the interview didn't go deeply into this, but I gather has been a topic in the past in different transgender instances in the public is the relationship between sexuality and gender. Now, is it right to bundle them into one, or are they separate things?
Well, they are separate things, but it's the way that our language is. Shows how much gender is a part of so many different things. For example, a lesbian and a heterosexual may both be attracted to women, but we would label one a lesbian if it was a woman, and we would label the other one a heterosexual man if it was a man. So the attraction is still to women. But when you, what you have with someone like Bruce Jenner is we got to change our language because our language is dependent on whether Bruce is seen as a woman or as a man.
Here's a clip of Bruce responding to Diane Sawyer asking him if he's a lesbian.
You're going back to the sex thing, and it's apples and oranges. There's two different things here. Sexuality is who you are personally attracted to, who you, you know, turns you on, male or female. But gender identity is how to do with who you are as a person and your soul and who you identify with inside.
You know, it's interesting hearing him talking about that. As a general rule, it seems as though it's comforting to put people into categories. We like to ask exactly what's going on with people to put them in the right category and to move on, but it seems as though maybe part of this whole journey with transgender awareness is realizing that, that some things are more fluid and that maybe there are not always easy categories.
Well, I think things are more fluid than many people would think. For instance, many of the spouses of transgender people do, in fact, stay with them through the transition and after, which makes them, in essence, switch their sexual orientation. I mean, they are now with the opposite gender of who they were originally attracted to. So I think that that also shows there is some fluidity.
We're talking right now to Laree Cook Daniels about transgender people, tied to Bruce Jenner's interview Friday night with Diane Sawyer about being transgender.
And we're taking your calls now. What questions do you have about being transgender, transgender identity? Are you trans or are you close with someone else who is? What is it like to be transgender? Call in and share your questions, maybe your experiences or those of your family. You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in a minute. Right now, a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion now with Laree Cook Daniels with Forge, a transgender advocacy organization. We're talking about what it means to be transgender in light of Bruce Jenner's interview Friday night on his decision to go public with being transgender.
We're taking your calls now. Are you transgender yourself? Do you know someone else who is? Someone close to you? A friend? A family member? What is it like? What is it like to be transgender or the friend or partner of someone who is? Do you have questions about what this is all about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you could post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Jacqueline with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi. I am trans. I've been out for a couple decades. I was married, divorced when I came out. Times were quite a bit different back then when I came out. There was no tolerance for trans. And for being gender fluid, there was zero tolerance even within the trans community. But one of the comments I would make, you were talking about sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. And for those of us who have been divorced, it's a very lonely existence because very few people are interested in dating trans. Lesbians really aren't interested in dating a trans woman. Gay men aren't interested. Straight men aren't interested in dating a trans woman who's sexually attracted to men. It's, it can be very lonely. And you're often judged solely based on what you are, a trans. They never look below the skin at who I am, what my interests are besides being trans.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for those thoughts. I really appreciate you calling in and sharing your experience with us, Jacqueline. And, you know, he was talking about the loneliness factor there, and that's something that Bruce Jenner said, that it was lonely, that it was, he was a lonely child and a lonely adult now. Is that something that people have to grapple with when they're dealing with transgender issues, Laree?
Well, I think it depends a lot on who you are. I think some people can hold secrets or know something about themselves that they're not sharing and be able to relate to people pretty well. Other times I do, in fact, see that when people are holding their identity inside, that their relationships are rather fragile and because they're holding people at arm's length. They're not being who they are, and that can affect how deep those relationships can go. And I think for trans people who are single, dating is a little bit more difficult because most people are still not aware of trans people and still think it's kind of strange, and do I really want to date someone who's trans? I think that that will go away as society becomes more aware of trans people among us.
Jacqueline, thanks for that call. We're going to go next to Barry joining us in Rice Lake. Hi, Barry.
Hello. My question was that beyond the perception or presentation of how someone wants to represent themselves, what your goal as an organization is for legal change.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Barry. What do you think in terms of legal change, maybe protections in the workplace? Are there goals that the transgender community has high on the list?
Yes, there are definitely goals. And I think that they're the same sorts of civil rights goals that every stigmatized minority has had throughout U.S. history, which is to have the laws all applied equally and to have people treated as they are inherently, according to their inherent value, as opposed to whatever stereotypes are being projected onto them. So, yes, we want job protections. We want to be able to use the bathroom that fits us. We want to be able to marry our spouses. So it's the same sorts of things that people want across the board.
Barry, thanks a lot for that. We're going to go next to Mallory joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Mallory.
Hi. So I just was like, you had been talking about transitioning later in life, and I mean, I'm going to be 30 this year, and I just, like, about a year ago first started going through the whole transition thing. And I mean, one thing that I really deal with is, you know, like, you doubt yourself so much because, like, it's like, you know that you've always felt this way, but at the same time, you spent so much time, you know, being who you were. And that's a really weird struggle that, like, I mean, I'm in a couple support groups, and most of the people in there are much younger, and they don't have that, you know, like, doubt at all, because it's like, well, as soon as their sexuality started budding, they knew right where they were going. But, you know, someone like me, who was raised really Catholic, you know, that wasn't an option when I was going through that part of my life. But, I mean, I've talked to a bunch of older trans people, and, like, you know, they've told me that it's like, yeah, that was pretty normal for my experience. I mean, now it's so different with the internet and everything, you know, like, you can just go find people to be like, you know, like, to give support. I mean, not trying to make it sound like it's easy or anything, but it's just a different perspective.
Got it. Thank you so much for those thoughts, Mallory. And Mallory getting at, in a way, at least for some people, maybe having been brought up in particular circumstances, having to choose, it almost sounds like, between an old version of themselves and this new version. And sometimes it's painful or difficult to make that call.
I think that's true. And I think that's particularly true, as Mallory noted, for I would have thought people older than Mallory. But because they were told for so many decades that is not who you are, you can't possibly be that a lot of them went to the other extreme. So, for instance, with trans people, we have a much higher rate of veterans, military veterans, because particularly the people who felt they were feminine went into the military to try to prove to everyone that, in fact, they were masculine. So that they really went to the extremes of being macho men before they finally admitted it just was not working.
And Mallory pointed to the internet as something that could change things, because you can find people who are like you. You can have someone to talk to and connect with who can maybe mentor you through a process like transitioning or coming out as transgender. Has the internet really changed things?
The importance of the internet cannot be overstated for the transgender community, because we couldn't find ourselves in libraries. We couldn't find ourselves on TV. We couldn't find ourselves in books. So we were really out there often thinking we were it. We were alone. There was nobody like us. And now with the internet, people with unusual interests, not that this is unusual, but that non-common interests can find other people like them. And it has totally changed the transgender experience.
It's interesting. You just said not that this is unusual. How common is transgender identification in our society?
We do not have any nationally representative studies. The federal government is just beginning to add some gender identity questions into their surveys, so it's going to be several years before anyone can say with any kind of authority what the percentage is. Our guess is it's somewhere between 0.5% and 1% of the population.
I want to talk a bit about family issues and people who are involved in the lives of transgender people. Now, in addition to being in the spotlight himself, Bruce also has a very public family, the Kardashians, a reality TV show. You know, I was struck in the interview when he said, you know, here was this one true story that he felt he couldn't tell in this reality TV show that's been going on for seasons and seasons. And this is the biggest story, in a way, out of that television show. And part of this was the family. He didn't want to hurt his family. What are some of the issues that family members of transgender or partners of transgender people have?
Well, one of them was discussed in the Jenner interview, where there was a discussion about what are your children going to call you? And he said, they're still going to call me Dad. That is a question that every family has to answer. And the answers could be multiple types of answers. Not everyone decides, yes, I'm still going to be Dad, like Bruce did. But that's one of the options, and you've got to negotiate that. In some families, if the trans person is going to try to not be as public as Bruce, they may need to negotiate, what can you talk about in the past, and how are you going to talk about me? For people that have very gendered roles in their families, like fathers do one thing and mothers do another, they may have to adjust. Well, is it okay to have a mother that does that? You know, is it okay to have a mother that works on the cars? So there may be a lot of adjustments for family members to work through, just because so much of our society is gendered. It throws up a lot of questions.
Now, in the past, as the gay marriage rights movement advanced, a lot of people pointed to media, to TV shows, for instance, like Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, as vehicles that sort of normalized gay people for a lot of America. Do you see that same thing happening with this?
Absolutely. I think we've had a couple of shows recently with transgender characters, but no one had 17 million viewers. Bruce has opened a new door.
And as we watch Bruce Jenner go through this part of his life very publicly with Diane Sawyer, I assume it will become part of the Keeping Up with the Kardashians TV show. What do you hope that people take away from his story?
I hope that what people take away from these stories is that even though these are celebrities on reality TV and are living lives that seem larger than life, in fact, we are all the same kind of human beings, still struggling to live our lives in ways that feel true to who we are.
Laurie, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
That was Laurie Cook Daniels, Policy and Program Director for FORGE, a national transgender advocacy organization headquartered in Milwaukee. She was with us to talk about what it means to be transgender after Bruce Jenner's interview last Friday night with Diane Sawyer.